session number 11770, reel 4.
You were saying that the Germans knew you as the Sons of Menelaus.
Yes, in any case, they referred to us once as such. Then after that action in 43, we did some supporting work to special operation executives work. We brought officers of Allied commandos across for operations on the coast. It's a I think it was the detection of their obstacles. And we did, I think, three of those operations. We did some more mine laying. We were also engaged in that in the preparations for D-Day, but only in the Allied effort to have that... to make the Germans believe that there was going to be a landing on the coast somewhere north of Dieppe and all that. And then I was sent at one operation, which a single boat operation, which I to my last days will regret that didn't come off. It's one of those things that you are given a great chance and to do something special, and it doesn't work. And that, of course, is an enormous disappointment, because if you are given a specific job to do by yourself, that is more important than any work that you might do. There was one moment that a German freighter was making a dash for the harbor of Dunkirk and was going to get as close inshore as he could under Cap Griné and then get into Dunkirk. And I was available, my moat was operational, and I was sent out by myself to see whether it would be possible as a single boat to get myself mixed up in a convoy and coastal shipping near Dunkirk. A flotilla would have been easily to be observed, but if you go out by a single boat, they might mistake you for one of their own. And I was supported by, in the beginning, to go across by MGBs from Ramsgate. And I went in across the different, there are quite a lot of banks in front of it, of near Dunkirk. You see, I've been so long out of the Navy, I don't know the terms anymore. And we came across and we came within the channel in front of Dunkirk and got inside of the ship too, that we were supposed to do. But one unknown reason, only one of the torpedoes fired and the other not. We were not observed. We had an exchange of signals which was rather beautifully done by my signalman who after he got the reconnaissance signal of one of the German escort vessels, he immediately passed that signal on to the boat in front of it, who would also to be observed, also close by, about 500 yards or so. He got the proper response and passed the response on to the first boat, which I'm eternally grateful for. Very, very quick-mindedness on that score. So we were not observed. And then we fired our first torpedo, and the second one did not. We were still not observed, So we made it a tour round, and then we fired our second torpedo. By that time, the ship had in fact already, was already entering harbor, and a single torpedo, no. So that was also, by that time they did discover that there was somebody in the neighborhood, and we got out as fast as we possibly could, because that still is, I would say, from all the disappointments in wartime, my greatest disappointment of all, to being that close to something and not successful.
The chances of hitting with one torpedo are too remote.
It's too remote. You have a chance if you have this double shot. You have a chance. And at that stage, of course, the ship had an profile. It was still across our bows. But by the time that I fired the single one, it was already, the entering the harbor, and the profile was minimal.
When was that?
That was oh my goodness, that must have been somewhere in before, must have been March, I think, it was before the invasion, must have been March 1944, but I forget.
You said that you were engaged on this deception work.
Yes.
At the time of D-Day. What did
Before that, just before that, they did all these things with balloons and rattles and gunfire and heaven knows what.
Off the Padakale.
Yes, that's right, that area. And
you mentioned the SOE work, landing agents. Can you say more in detail about how that was done?
No, what we did is that you went across then the dinghies. With a small boy was established, a tiny boy with, I remember, only a minute light. And at that stage, we had this new navigational aid called DECA. I think it was called DECA. But the navigational aid which you really can pinpoint, and we could pinpoint a place where that was possible. And a very small boy was left in that spot. And it was arranged that after the operation, the boat would come back to that particular spot, and you could come back within, let's say, the distance of this room. You could get yourself back in that spot, and we picked them up again afterwards, because they, with their dinghy, were able to come and return on the particular boat. And that was for us, terribly, terribly interesting and very good work.
And this was in the same area of the...
That's in the same area. It was all in that area south of Cap Grenier. But the extraordinary thing is that so many of... There are people that can remember, these things in precise detail. They can remember names, and they can remember all these things. For me, I don't know. I always am a bit doubtful. But in the end, there are people who can remember these things. Absolutely, perfectly, every face. Look at Michael Forsyth. He remembers these things in the utmost detail. And when you check them, or you see old letters and old papers... He got them absolutely straight. There's no question about it. It isn't fantasy. It is that. Although, not because I've always felt particularly, I think there's so much, perhaps too easily diverted in things. There's so many things that I like to do or like to see or observe or happening to me that are that I'm interested in. Perhaps my concentration on one particular effort or any effort is not strong enough. I'm not a man enough of a singleness of purpose. But I've had many meetings during the war, which I've altogether have taken on an importance equal to the what was actually happening. And one small example. That I, in Shoreham when I was repairing my my boat was being repaired, the M204 was being repaired. I meet in a pub in an evening, I meet a man older than myself, I think his younger 40s, who after conversation invites me to come and have tea with him in his flat in Brighton. And there he shows me a collection, I think, of 12 drawings and paintings of Picasso. No? That for me was as great and of that of the period of the family of the rose period and blue, and that for me was an impression as strong as almost any other things. Not that I have been a constant admirer of Picasso, but the fact of being confronted by an artist of that magnitude is in things that overrides other influences. I met people in London during that time. I think you meet other people. When we got out of the out of Mr. Janssen, I was on board with a great war correspondent, George Weller of the Chicago Daily News. I met Ian Morrison when I arrived in Australia, and I became very close to Ian Morrison and to Mrs. Morrison, the one of the Times man. I brought his manuscript, I think it was the second copy of his manuscript, I brought to London to his publishers, Faber and Faber. 24 hours after I left in London, I was staying in Winfield House with the Kinnerleys at that particular state. I mean, all these things during the war, things are happening outside the actual or away from the actual terror of war, and they are not necessarily, they don't take you away from it, but they are other impressions, and it makes up all these impressions. My first confrontation with Posen, over the first confrontation, let's say, with things, I mean, Posen, or the paintings of a man called Walter Spies, who is a great German painter who worked in Bali, whose paintings had been collected by Barbara Hutton, been brought, number of them, to London, and were in Winfield House. And I, through this connection of Ian Morrison and Faber and Faber, who was at that moment run by a great friend of theirs, the Kinnerleys, who lived in Winfield House, you are confronted with something that is part of it all. And so life is full of chance meetings. I mean, to have met the son of the great General de Gaulle, having conversations with him, hearing about him, not necessarily as the great French war leader, but also as a father. No? All these things make up a life in which one forgets some of the
combat details. How did you come to leave the 9th Motor Torpedo Flotilla in 1944?
In 1944, the flotilla was on orders of the Netherlands Naval Command in London, was disbanded from one day to the other, because they said that the naval personnel was necessary for working groups on ashore in the Netherlands for, I don't know, to reconstruction, rehabilitation, recovery of the Netherlands and all that, and all the experience of officers and personnel and everything was out of the window from one day to another, although coastal forces were still operating in in the Mediterranean and elsewhere, and that was considered more important. And I spent the next 6 months of the war in London, and I think I was in charge of the repatriation of naval wives from South Africa, Australia and the rest, all being repatriated because the Netherlands was going to be free.
When did you first get back to the Netherlands?
In May in June 1945. June 45, I came back. My first visit was in June 1945. And by that time, I got a more important, slightly more sensible job, is to indoctrination of naval, of recruits who had been recruited for the Dutch Navy in the Netherlands, Brabant, and in the southern provinces, which had been liberated, and prepare them for a task in the Netherlands East Indies. I had, by that time, it was known that I was going to be declared medically unfit for return to the tropics because of a skin disease, which is now over with modern medicines, it's all gone, but that was not possible. So I was then given the task of doing that, giving lectures, pep talks, and lectures to young recruits. I did that first in Skegness, and or I did it in Skegness and in other parts where we had our training camps for the Netherlands Navy. And then I had already, long before, already in the middle of the war, decided that after the war I wanted to enter the Foreign Service. I had been asked by the Foreign Service too, during the war, whether it would have been possible for me to go earlier, but under no condition. I decided that was not what was possible.
Could I ask you about your impressions of the country when you got back there after the war, what condition it was in?
The first thing, and the most strongest of all, is the not necessarily devastation of the country as such, which seemed to be almost unharmed, but it was the extraordinary impoverishment of the people themselves. Not only that they were hardly visible, I mean they were so underfed that it was awful. I remember very well that the very first word that my mother, after 5 years, uttered when I arrived at home, she said, "Ellie, you are beautifully fat." you've been in Dutch expression, you've been so mooi dik, you are so beautifully rounded. And because they really, I mean, that was miserable. But it was also the condition, with very few exceptions, they were so browbeaten, they were so, I mean, they were really drained of all the things that make up a normal and healthy and strong person. They were drained. They were utterly weary. And that was even the part where my father was comparatively lucky by still having been able to find and having a son nearby who was able to help and to provide. One of my brothers lived quite a long way away, so he couldn't directly help. My second brother was made a prisoner of war in the Dutch East Indies. I was the only one that came from, that had been outside. So it was impressed upon me the enormous difference between those that had been abroad and those that had been left behind under occupation. The difference in mentality, the totally different aspect of a war, which had nothing and no relation to a fighting war. The one was almost deaf to the other one. They wanted to tell their story. They wanted to hear my story, but they really weren't able to absorb it. They were not able to really take it in the way and in the manner that we took it in. Neither were we, who had been abroad, and I was very fortunate of being outside all during the war, able to really conclude or to let's say, in one way, to gauge the effect it had on them. We don't know anything about people that have been under occupation.
Had it changed their attitudes?
Oh, yes. It changed their attitude. They were with the Allies so completely that it was a matter of faith. For the great, let's say, majority of people. But on the other hand, it had demanded an absolute subservience and in order to stay alive, let alone anything else. So, I mean, you could not from them expect any heroic gestures, far from it. Neither could they understand of what was happening in politics and in the world at large, because they had never heard anything about it. They heard something very, very small, a minute impression of it all. When my father heard of the defeat of Churchill in the elections after the war, he cried. He cried his eyes out, because that was for him something so totally. They had attached themselves to the smallest bits, to the smallest things that could console them or that strengthened them, etc. But they were small bits. There's one story which has always touched me enormously, is that when my name was mentioned in one of the during the war, I don't know for what operation it was, or I think it was for the fact when I got my DSC, it was mentioned by the Radio Oranje. And the day, I think it was the day itself, my parents went to a concert in a small concert hall in Dordrecht. And my parents said they had right in the front of the hall, they had their seats. And when they walked through the hall to their seats in the central aisle, people applauded.
Because they'd heard on radio.
They heard on the radio. You see, that is the kind. That is the kind of things. For them, those were moments that were absolute highlights. And things like that. Because everybody felt from where they were, but nobody could say anything about it, because you never could trust anybody but those that you really could trust. And that was very few and far between, that you knew that the other person was trustworthy and could be relied upon, because the punishment, etc., particularly for elderly people, was awful. So, and altogether, these are things that we do not, cannot possibly understand, even if we want to understand it, the depths of feeling. And at that time also, although it started, and it was already a month or more than a month that the country had been liberated in that sense, it took a very long time before one really was able to amalgamate or be part of it again. And because naturally, coming from abroad, you wanted to tell. And but that was not the first thing that they wanted to hear. What they wanted to hear is to be able, for the first time in their lives, to unburden themselves, because they had been put into a box and never allowed to say anything at all, because their feelings were at bursting point. And that's all.
What do you remember them telling you in particular?
Oh, particularly the last year, the last winter, when all the communications were cut after Arnhem, because that was the result of the failure of the Arnhem expedition. That is the most, those months were terrible.
Because the Western Netherlands were cut off?
No, completely. The German completely shut it off. There was no more food, nothing at all. And they really lived that last winter on a tenth of what they normally would have needed as such. Those were the strongest, I think, of all impressions, that thing.
What did they say to you about their feelings towards the Germans?
Extraordinary that you ask me that. I think that even now, or rather the other way around, it has always been a very muted not criticism, it certainly was a muted in hatred. The hatred was against specific people, those in command. It was not against men as such. They knew, of course, there were as many bastards there as anywhere else. I mean, there were particular ones that were, I mean, who really were Nazis.
So it wasn't a blanket condemnation.
It
of
was
German
not.
People.
It never been. It never been a blanket condemnation, because that is an extraordinary thing now. That is why the European community is for us such a terribly important aspect of it all. Because there were overriding sympathies of a human nature that had never been really extinguished or disappeared. And why is it, for example, I mean, why is it, for example, that we, as a government and also as a people, really generously welcomed a reunification? And for all the nations were things on. There was really hardly, I mean, it was not important at all, throughout France or the Netherlands or Belgium, etc., a feeling of a renewed danger, which was very apparent here, certainly in the government and in the leader of the government, a very strong anti-German feeling. The anti-German feeling is, as I experience it, much more strong and apparent in England, which has never been occupied, than in the Netherlands that had. Which is the thing always to remember, is always to remember that ultimately, I would say that the effect of occupation as such is of a different nature altogether. And it's very difficult for us. And I now consider myself of having lived here altogether for 10 years than anything else. That's all.
You were telling me earlier that you and your parents had not had any contact with each other during the
five years between
40 and 45.
No, little, I mean, just bits of news. They knew that I had escaped from the Dutch East Indies. That they know. And they knew that quite early. And I think it was one of the messages, I mean, whether it was Red Cross or something, but the message that reached them. Many of these things reached them in peculiar ways that other people... I have a letter in my possession that something that happened to me was related to them, and that was put into the letterbox. They don't know. They will never know who put it in the letterbox. And saying that I heard last night so and so and so and so. And never people telling you to your face what happened, but doing it in a way that nobody could possibly either detect it or know or where it came from. That is why in the anonymity of the resistance, what I said about my parents being applauded, because they all felt that they were safe in doing so, because they weren't alone. It is the face of the resistance which is a different nature altogether. And even after reading all the, or at least most of the history of the Netherlands during the time of the war, even after all that, reading all that, you still don't really get the clear and the true pictures. But one thing is most important of all, it has not left a lasting impression. We are at the moment further on the road to, let's say, European reconciliation and a European identity than other countries that have been outside, and particularly Britain.